Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another episode of The Kevin Rose Show. We are back in production. I took a couple weeks off and I'm going to resume my normal cadence of a couple of guests per month. This is a fun episode. I'm really excited to bring it to you because it really hits on something that I am super curious about, which is how to enhance the human brain and how to improve cognition and improve attention. I am a very, very distractible person. I'm a kind of 30 tab type of person. I click on my Gmail tab and realize that I hadn't sent an email. I hadn't clicked the send button because I got distracted onto something else. So it's attention and distraction are things that I've wanted to work on. Now, Adam Ghazali, who is an MD, PhD at UCSF, has been a friend of mine for, coming up on 10 or so years now. And it has been really awesome to watch his career since I've known him because, you know, he was always a great scientist and he's published just a ton of papers. I think he has over 130 scientific papers that he's authored now, but he's really started to explode and he's started to appear all over the place in terms of like media and the recognition that he's getting for the work that he's doing. So, you know, he's been on the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine, The New Yorker, CNN, NBC Nightly News, like all over the place. And he also recently authored, I guess it's been a little over a year, or maybe a year and a half ago, a book called The Distracted Mind. And the reason he's getting all this recognition is because he is doing some amazing work in creating these therapeutic video games. And when I first think of video games and kind of brain training, you think of like, you know, those Nintendo games that came out a decade or more ago. And then, of course, there's all kinds of like online brain training games and apps now. But those are just people kind of just guessing on what they think will improve cognition. And there's no real strong scientific rigor behind them. This is not that. This is real university created at UCSF, real placebo-controlled experiments that are being done, and they are showing real results, so much so that he has a video game right now that is in phase three trials at the FDA. So we're talking about this could be the world's first prescribable video game for the treatment of ADHD. Which is just unbelievable. Just this idea that we would now have a new path. And we really get into why this works and the secret sauce that he discovered in creating these kind of closed looped systems. So it's really fascinating research along with when you can expect this stuff to hit the market. And we also talk about some of his own personal daily regimen that he does to keep his brain strong and healthy. And yeah, one other thing I should mention that is if you're a science geek, you will know this magazine well. There's a magazine called Nature. And Nature is the kind of scientific journal. It is, if you can get the cover of Nature, like you've made it. That's like career making type stuff. And it was really cool to see that Adam made the cover of Nature, I guess about a year ago or so for his work on these therapeutic video games. Before we get started, though, I wanted to tell you about our sponsor. You know, if you've been listening to this podcast many times, I would say probably 75% of the time, I do not have a sponsor because I really want to just do stuff that I personally believe in. And Audible has been one of those companies that's backed me for a really long time. And it is a service that I use almost daily. So if you have yet to sign up for Audible, the easiest way to do it, and I can wait for you right now, is just to switch out of your podcast app right now. Go to your text messaging, type in 500-500 to send a text, and then just text Kevin Rose, all one word, and it'll send you a link. And through that link, you can then click on it. You'll get a 30-day free trial and also a free audiobook. And so this is great stuff for when you have some downtime. And for me, downtime means I'm still doing something. So oftentimes I'll be on my Peloton, like riding my bike, getting some cardiovascular exercise or at the gym or in the back of an Uber. So it's like that time that you can find when you're commuting or doing other things. And it's just time to learn something new. So I'm obviously a big fan of lifelong learning, and this is one of the ways that I do it. So you can text Kevin Rose to 500-500 and you'll get that link, or you can go to audible.com/Kevin Rose. That would be massive to help support the show. Now, the book that I'm recommending this month is one that actually Adam brings up, in this podcast. It's a friend of his that's also another PhD by the name of Matthew Walker, and it's a book called Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. So this is a scientist that has done a lot of research on sleep, and he gets into some really interesting questions around, you know, how caffeine and alcohol affect your sleep, what really happens during REM sleep, how our sleep patterns change across our lifetime, what sleep aids do to our sleep, and do they cause long-term damage. There's just it's a really fascinating read. I'm just getting into it now. It's got 4.8 score with 730 ratings. And this is actually, I believe, my last episode with Serge that we had. He also mentioned this book. Yeah, I know he did. So this is the second time we're getting this book recommended by a guest. So you know it's good when all these biohackers are really into it. So definitely check out Why We Sleep and get the link by texting 500-500. Text the word Kevin Rose. All right, let's get started. Here's my podcast with Dr. Adam Ghazali. So Adam, dude, awesome to have you on my show. We've been like buddies for years now. How long's it been?
It's probably close to a decade now.
That's insane.
Yeah, time goes fast.
I can't believe that. And I've obviously been a big fan of your research and been watching what you've been up to over the years and how that's evolved. And I got to say, part of this interview, I'm a little bit wanting to pick your brain because, you know, I've had issues with attention my entire life. Like Daria always calls me the most distractible like human. She's worried that our baby is also the same way because like there'll be a little sound that goes off and the baby looks in the other direction. She's like, "There's Kevin right there."
No.
Yeah. So you know, I wanna get into your research, what you've been doing, and like talk to people about how practical things they can do to improve their symptoms that they might have around distraction and focus and attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's my core of everything is how do we think about our brains and its interaction with our environment in terms of what makes us effective, productive, and happy, and then how do we get better at it? And at the core, you know, at the heart of all of that is attention. Mm-hmm. If you can't effectively deploy the limited resources that we have, which is the reality, where and when you want them, you know, you have a whole host of negative consequences around that.
Oh, dude, I know this so well. I remember at first in second grade, we were assigned to read a book. And I was reading through the book and it was, you know, it was a few pages in. And then my mind was in a completely different place. Not even at the book. It was like just, and that would happen every two or three pages. And I've always had that issue. Am I just like, is there something wrong with me? Do a lot of people have that issue? Or is that just...
I mean, it's incredibly common, especially in children and even teens that don't have the full development of their prefrontal cortex. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the most evolved part of our brain, right in the front. Mm-hmm. And it's what allows you to just essentially take control over how you interact with the world around you. Mm-hmm. When it is underdeveloped at any age or due to any condition, you are more responsive to the environment itself without your goals playing a role. So, you know, if you go back in time evolutionarily to how our brains first wound up here, how we have, you know, these amazing abilities that we think of as, you know, what makes us human now, it really started very simply to just navigate an environment. Even if you go to single-celled creatures, they had to be able to sense when there was something they needed, like a nutrient mm-hmm. or resource, and also sense when there was something threatening, like a toxin, and then respond accordingly, to go towards the nutrient, away from the toxin. That was it. That simple cycle between sensing your environment and responding to it led to the whole evolution of all brains on the planet now. And it's essentially what we do. We perceive and we act. The human brain has this higher level of function of being able to pause between a perception and an action. A lot of animals don't. We don't completely have the ability to break that cycle, that perception-action cycle. But when we can pause between perceiving something around us and not responding directly, reflexively, that is where we insert our attention, our goal-directed attention. Mm-hmm. And that ability to pause and reflect and make a decision and then act upon that decision has allowed everything that humanity has created, all technology, art, music, science, culture, exists only because of that. Mm-hmm. And so this is a long answer, but yeah, you're normal, because our brains have still deeply rooted in them these ancient responses to the environment that could derail our goals or become totally debilitating for many people that mm-hmm. just don't have this this attentional process of being able to disrupt that cycle.
So one question there. When you think about distraction and, you know, a shiny object goes by and all of a sudden my attention is pulled out of what I'm doing and now onto the shiny object, that's obviously one piece. For me, it's always been not the shiny object, but my own brain. They used to call it like daydreaming.
Yeah.
Right. So where I go into a different mode where I'm like, oh, what if this happened? And I think there's a lot of creativity in that space mm-hmm. because you can like you go into your own head and you start dreaming up new ideas, new things. But that's where I get the distraction. How is that different?
Yeah, it's a great observation. I guess it's been almost 6 years ago, I published a conceptual framework of thinking about more broadly what I call interference. So interference exists on many levels, like the noise when you're trying to pick up a radio signal and you're like, you know, that's noise, that's interference.
Right.
We have interference and noise in our goals, in our goal accomplishment. And that can be divided into four different types. So two main categories of interference that I break down are distractions and then interruptions. So distractions, let's start with this. Distractions are irrelevant information that you know is irrelevant, that you're actually wanting to ignore to accomplish your goal. Mm-hmm. And then interruptions are when you make the decision about engaging simultaneously in another stream mm-hmm. of information. So a lot of people call interruption multitasking.
Interesting.
Both distraction and interruption degrade performance. That's very clear. We've done, you know, well over a decade of research with functional brain imaging showing that. Now, both distractions and interruptions have something in common. They can occur externally or internally, both of them. So that's why you wind up with four. So let's start with distraction. You just perfectly described it. Distractions could be external. So things in the environment that are very salient or very novel pull your attention independent of your goals. Vibrations, flashes of light, loud sounds, even your name, which has now become very salient.
You're basically describing an iPhone. Vibrations, loud
sounds. Oh, yes.
Yeah, any device.
We will come back to that.
Yeah.
That is at the root of why technology is so challenging to us, is that it does co-opt this very ancient system of what we call bottom up. It's how the environment imposes itself upon your attention mm-hmm. as opposed to your goals directing it. So that's an external distraction. An internal distraction is exactly as you described it. You know, you don't want to think about the argument you had with your wife or husband last night while you're talking to your boss the next morning.
Right.
But you do anyway.
And it'll
degrade the interaction. And you're aware of it. You're trying to suppress it. So we call those mind-wandering events. They're internal distractions. Research shows, and the reason I gave that example, is that most of those are negative. The majority of those type of internal distractions are not positive, but they're negative when people report on them, when they're asked to report on them.
Hmm.
And then just to wrap this up, so that's two right there. So internal and external distractions, and then you could have interruptions and multitasking on both domains as well. So you could be having a conversation and listening to the waiter, you know, sort of describe the dinner special at
right.
the next table.
I do that all the time.
Like, I missed it the first time, so I'm just going to simultaneously pay attention yeah. to you and do that.
Yeah, and then Dari like snaps like, Kevin, like here.
It's like, you're not here, right?
Right, exactly.
So that's an external type of multitasking. You're taking in verbal information from your conversation and you're listening to something.
Right.
You can do it internally as well. So now it's not really mind wandering in the sense that you're like, don't think about that. You're like, I'm going to have a conversation with you and also think about what I'm going to have for dinner tonight.
Right.
And so those four sets of interference all degrade performance, and different people are susceptible to different, you know, types of them.
Yeah. And I would imagine, like, even when we're having this conversation, you're saying things that create these little branches off of the main tree that are creating little, oh, I should think about this and ask this next question. Mm-hmm. So like that's happening during our entire conversation. And then I try and like prune it back and bring it back to the main thread.
Right.
That's just normal though, right?
Right. So what you just described there, you're really good at this. So what you just described there is something we call working memory. A lot of people get confused about what working memory is. It's a term that is used a lot. It's even in the sort of popular media now. It's not long-term memory. It's not the type of memory that you might even have an hour later. We consider actually that a type of long-term memory. It's online memory. It's exactly what you were just describing. It's you had a thought. You're not going to engage in it and go off on it, but you just want to hold it there, sort of on an active like little scratch pad to bring back.
But you might have to play with it a little bit to see what question you wanted to get out of it to slice that back in, right?
Undoubtedly, another aspect of working memory is not just maintenance but manipulation, and they're both aspects of working memory. Now, if you totally got pulled off on a new path with every new thought or every new perception in your environment, everything that you see, every stimuli, you would be completely ineffective.
Right.
Right. So there is, you know, there's this balance. And you described something really important, that distraction, especially that internal mind wandering, is a place of creativity. And even external distractions could be a place of creativity. You could have an observation about something in the world that's independent of your goals that then makes a connection for you.
Right.
And so people often say to me, well, you know, I wrote a book called The Distracted Mind, so I get a lot of questions related to all aspects of distraction. And someone will say, well, you know, artists, like I'm an artist, I'm a musician, like I create, and I need to be distracted because that allows me to make, you know, all these leaps of imagination. And there's something to that. But I also then, you know, sort of respond by saying, if you are so distracted that you were always in your imagination and always making these leaps, you would not be a successful musician like you are now. Mm. So you need a balance. You need to be able to go there to travel independent of your goals, but you have to get it back and you have to be goal directed in order to actually produce something.
So when at what point do you look at someone, you see a patient, because you're not only a PhD, but you're an MD as well. You know, if you were to see a patient and say, okay, you've clearly gone too far, like there's something, whether you classify something as ADHD or, you know, I'm sure there's dementia, a handful of other dementia
on the other
like
end
that,
of the lifespan.
What do you look for, or how do you feel that like someone can say, okay, this is something I need to spend some time on? Because we'll get into what you're developing, which I think is fascinating, the ways to address this without using drugs. When is enough enough?
Yeah, it's another really, really great question, because it's at the core of the entire dilemma that the medical system is in right now around these diagnoses, because they're all on a spectrum. Right, we use that term spectrum frequently for autism. Now, it's all a spectrum. The full range of attention abilities will be in any classroom or any group of friends at any age. And so, where do you draw the line? Where is it now a medical clinical diagnosis versus just, you know, that's Tim, you know, that's how his brain works.
Yeah.
And so usually what we do, and this is why it's so sloppy, is that we draw the line at functional impairment. Right. So dementia, let's talk about the diagnosis of dementia. That's the area of medicine that I've spent more time, like early Alzheimer's disease as a neurologist. It's dementia is a syndrome that's defined as a decline in cognitive abilities. So it can't be, it's not a developmental disorder. It actually has to be a decline. It could be attention, just like we see in ADHD. But then it has to have reached a level that leads to functional impairment. That's a blurry line. Like if your function is to sit on the couch and watch TV, it could be a long time before we find out that you're demented. If you're still a CEO, well, actually CEOs are sort of complicated because they're often protected by an executive team.
Right.
But like if you're really in a demanding position that's constantly pushing you, your functional impairment will present itself much earlier. Mm. And so we don't have a great answer for where that line is. And that's why if you look at how we make clinical decisions, such as the one for ADHD, we use something called the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistics Manual, that is basically just a set of symptoms that if you see in a patient as a physician, you could make that diagnosis. But we change it every time we have a new manual, just showing our lack of clarity. You know, we don't really have those specific biological markers like we do for diabetes of sugar or, you know, cholesterol levels. And so The answer
really
is we don't
fuzzy,
really know.
Basically.
It is it is super fuzzy, and that's why, you know, everyone is concerned about the system, from the physicians to the parents to the kids to the, you know, the regulators, the reimbursers, even the pharmaceutical companies themselves. know that we're not in a really tight situation here of being able to make very precise quantitative decisions and helping people. And that's sort of the dilemma that we're in.
I'd love to chat about some of your research over the years and where you are today, because you are on the path of becoming the first video game that is FDA approved, knock on wood.
Yeah.
And that is just insane. Can you talk about like just how you got started down this path, what you wanted to address, and where you are today?
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, it was a good discussion that we had about attention, because that started it all for me. I'd been studying how our brains are susceptible to interference, like we've been talking about distraction and multitasking, how it gets worse as we get older, which is very prominent and very clear, not just from our own research, but everyone's pretty much. We see that again and again. And I've been studying the brain at that point for 20 years. And I decided in 2008, that it was just not what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. Studying the brain is fascinating. You could go through more and more detailed research into every single aspect. And a lot of scientific careers, you know, progress that way. I call it spiraling reductionism. You're constantly going for a further detail until, you know, at the end, you're the only one that cares about what you found. And right. I wanted to go the opposite direction. I wanted to, instead of just search for more and more details about what we found related to distraction and multitasking, I wanted to see if we could use our expertise in neuroscience and our methodology to flip the story around, to find ways to actually improve our attention abilities. And so this is 2008, so 10 years ago now, around the time that we met. And I was interested in the idea of not reaching for what I as a neurologist would automatically do, which is a small molecule, a pharmaceutical, a drug, goes by all those names, which is how we tend to think about approaches to improve cognition, whether that cognition deficit is in the emotional regulation domain, like depression or anxiety, or it's an attentional problem or a memory problem. That is what we think about. That's our toolkit, and has been for 60 years. Mm-hmm. And we know that they're not very targeted treatments. They act generally on the neurotransmitter system of the brain, but it's blunt. It's not targeted to the networks of the brain. Mm. And so when we want to improve someone's depression, we increase the doses until we're seeing a benefit. But because those treatments are not targeted to like the depression system specifically, we wind up getting all these other effects that we call side effects.
Right.
And so it's problematic. And we've never, ever created any molecules that target brain networks. The only thing...
Can you explain by targeting brain networks? How does that differ?
Yeah, so you have how our brain works at the highest level of our understanding right now is that you don't have these neurotransmitter systems doing one particular things like dopamine, even though it's highly associated with reward, as everyone know, or glutamate or the cholinergic system. They act in very complex ways depending upon how the brain is activated. And not also saying that this brain area does this, this does that. That's also a naive way of looking at the brain.
Interesting.
The brain works as an interactive dynamic network. One area could be doing something very different depending on what other areas are doing and depending about the chemical sort of balance between them. And it's
can one get out of whack?
Oh, undoubtedly.
So you could improve one area. If you try to improve one area, could you lift like the entire system?
Well, I think a more realistic way of thinking about it is how to move the whole network. So yes, we often try to target brain areas, but it's sort of, again, naive. And we have been naive in neuroscience for a long time. The brain really is a multivariate system, meaning that its emergent properties that we call cognition really exists because of the interactions between regions. It's the network property of the brain that really defines how we function. And so the network, how you act, you know, I'm like using my hands here and only you could see it, but you know, you could picture all these little points, like a picture, like a map of the airport terminals across the United States.
Sure.
You know, all the hubs, you have a United hub here and you have all these lines, different thicknesses, depending on how frequent those routes are traveled. That's like what a brain network looks like. And we're beginning to understand that now through research. That network might underlie what you're doing at the moment. And there are different levels of neurotransmitters across that entire network. So the chemical aspect of it doesn't encode all the detail. It's the functional relationships between all the areas of the network that really leads to the specificity of the of what's going on in your brain right now.
So it sounds like you have to look at this at a much like greater abstracted, holistic point of view versus very like segmented and individual.
Undoubtedly. So there's two mistakes. You could look at each brain area as an island. That is a mistake. That's not how the brain works. And you could also just look at a neurotransmitter system as if it does one thing. That's also not how it works. Way more complicated than that. That's where we started on our understanding, but we know that that is not how the brain works. And so we're, as a field, moving to this level of looking at the network properties of the brain. So if we want to activate a network in someone's brain, we know that we have never accomplished that with a molecule, with a small molecule or drug. Never, it's never happened. We've tried to do it. We've never done it. We cannot do it electrically by stimulating.
How would you know if you had done it? Like, what would you have to look at? What data would you be presented with to say like, ah, that molecule is actually activating the network of the brain?
I mean, you could look at it with neuroimaging.
What would you see exactly?
I mean, you would see like a set of areas light up, to use a, you know, a sort of non-descriptive word there. But mostly what we're looking for are areas that are activating in synchrony with one another. Mm. So these are terms that we use in our lab, like coherence. They're related to like even the rhythmic fluctuations of activities across different brain areas. And when they become locked, like when you're in rhythm with someone, when you're nodding your head at the same time or dancing with someone, these rhythmic connectivities are how networks synchronize. Mm.
So you can see when someone's out of sync then, basically.
Yeah, you know, we look at brain rhythms to understand the synchronization across networks.
Is that a science now to where you could almost see what's wrong without talking to the patient just by looking at a brain scan? Like, could you look and be like, ah, I see it's a little off sync, probably depression, or is that too early days?
Once again, I would say that it's probably not the best route. You want to activate the brain and then look at how it's functioning. Right. And that's, and so you want to do that both on the assessment side, which is what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And so we do that all the time where we engage someone in a certain way to understand how their brain networks are activating so we could see whether or not it's happening at a high level or it's dysfunctional in some way. So on the assessment side, we're trying to engage networks selectively to understand how they're functioning. But on the treatment side, we want to do the same thing. So I'll wrap around to your original question because we could go off on these tangents because they're fascinating and they're relevant. But so what I was trying to describe is that we don't have a way using any approach in our modern day medical toolkit to activate networks selectively. And it leads to a whole host of problems related to personalization, related to targeting and side effects. The only way we know to activate a brain network selectively is by having an experience. Mm-hmm. That right now, your brain is activating selectively so easily just because that is how the brain works.
Right.
And so instead of fighting what our wet word does naturally, my idea was to just embrace it and use it. Hmm. And so not only does your brain act selectively when you engage in experience, but it also has the ability to modify itself, which we call plasticity.
So let me get this straight, just to like kind of break this down. Are you talking about, for example, if you show someone an image of something, it's going to activate a portion of the brain, a certain portion of the brain. Mm-hmm. It's almost like going to the gym and saying, I want to work out my bicep and knowing
exactly like that.
Okay.
Even better, if I didn't just show you an image, but I said, think about the color red or make a decision based on this or pay attention to this and ignore this. I mean, that's what we do with our cognitive paradigms is we give you a very, not just stimuli, but a specific goal. And then we could see brain networks that act pretty systematically across individuals with some variation. So the idea is activate the brain network through an experience. And then by constantly applying pressure, again, similar to the gym analogy, then you can change and optimize the functioning of that specific network over time.
Hmm.
Because the brain has plasticity.
And this is why you got the cover of Nature, basically.
Exactly. So how do you create an experience that changes the brain? There's lots of them. We have many examples of horrible ones, right? You could see something tragic that detrimentally impacts the function of your brain for the rest of your life.
Oh, wow.
PTSD.
Wait, but let me ask you a question.
It's an experience that changes a network.
This is crazy, and I want to get your take on it. What about like horror films, like really bad movies, things of that nature? Do you think that has a cognitive impact on people, like watching that type of material and feeling those emotions?
Any experience has the power of being transformative in a good or a bad way. It depends on a lot of the context of that person's, you know, brain and their previous memories and the context of the situation they're in at the moment. So sure, I think it's naive to say that experiences can't transform, because they can and they do all the time. And often they're negative. But what I became really excited about in 2008 was thinking about how to create experiences that transform, not just through a single moment, not like that wow, epiphany, transformative experience, but through practice. Mm-hmm. Now, we have ancient examples of this, like the whole contemplative traditions and mindfulness practices of meditation are exactly these. They're experiences that you engage in that activate the brain selectively, mm-hmm. that you practice again and again to refine and optimize how those networks engage.
Mm.
That is exactly what meditation is. And we've abandoned a lot of that. I think we are rediscovering it, especially in some places in the world like San Francisco and yeah. other places, but certainly not on a wide scale level.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know that practices like meditation are really hard. They're inaccessible to a lot of people for many reasons. But if we could make an experience that activates the brain selectively, because it's very prescribed and very detailed in what you're doing. And then it's adaptive, meaning that it's constantly reading out how you are performing in the moment and challenging you right at that sweet spot where it's not so hard or it's so easy, just at that point by using your data in real time.
Right. So it's like the gym, the weight's not too heavy, it's not too light.
Exactly. It's like having a personal trainer every millisecond.
Right.
So we call this the closed loop. And everything we do here is closed loop. And so a closed loop system is where you intervene in some way that might be engaging in experience or going to the gym, and then you use the data that's being generated, like I can't lift that, to then adjust, ideally in real time, the weight that you're using.
Hmm.
That's a closed loop system. We use it in thermostats. We use it in modern day dryers so that you don't have to put in how long to dry your clothes. It's reading out the moisture in the dryer. It knows when your clothes are dried. Those are closed loop systems. We have many of them in the physical world, but not many in the biological world. And think about how open loop system the medical care is right now. So you have depression, very complex, right? We diagnose you based on really poor assessments, and then we give you a drug that is non-selective to your networks and not personalized to you in any way.
It's the exact same drug that millions of people are getting prescribed.
Right, at a dose that was based on a population study that doesn't speak to you as an individual.
Right.
So it has all those disadvantages to go in. And then what happens? You go home and you take it for months, subjectively monitoring how well it's working and your side effects. You go back to your doctor and then your doctor's like, we're going to go up 10 milligrams on that. That is like a completely ineffective open loop system.
Right.
We have to close the loop, right?
I've experienced this personally. So for example, you know, Peter Attia, the crazy body hacking doctor that's always on Tim's show, he's my doctor as well. And he's working with cholesterol meds for me. The Crestor is my drug. And he goes, okay, based on your blood work, and he's doing a lot of blood panels on me, he goes, based on your blood work, I want to go up just on Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And so he's really trying to create a little bit more of a closed loop system.
He is trying to create a closed loop system.
And so
it's very hard to do with molecules, but he's trying to do it.
Here's the funny thing. I go to get mine refilled and I get rejected. And the insurance company is like, what are you doing? You can't
We
don't know what that is.
Yeah.
And I'm like, are you kidding me? He's trying to personalize this, create the optimal dosage, not overdose me.
Yeah.
And they rejected my claim and they wouldn't fill my prescription.
Yeah, it's because the system's completely broken.
That's
and
crazy.
And we have this really, you know, incumbent institution that is, you know, been going for hundreds of years, both our medical system and now how we deploy pharmaceuticals. And it's, you know, it doesn't rely on good assessments. It's non-personalized. It's poorly targeted. and it's open loop. And so this is the current state of affairs. So when it came to thinking about how do we prove attention abilities back to 2008, I'm like, I want something that's an experience and I want a closed loop. What better way to do that than through a video game?
That's awesome.
And so that's basically the story. I was like, we could create a video game from scratch that is fun and engaging. So you get deep immersion in the moment, which I think is critical to change the brain, to change anything, right? If you're not deeply involved in your workout and just going through the motions, you know, you're not going to get in better physical shape. Same thing for the brain. So video games have that aspect of story, music, art, rewards that really pull you in. But then the mechanics of the game activate brain networks selectively. That's the experience. And then using a closed loop, all of your performance metrics, how fast and accurate you are, can be recorded by the software in real time and then used to update the challenge. Used to update the challenge in real time.
So they're recorded in real time based on your success of playing the
or failures, yes.
Or failures. Okay. So can you talk about, you know, obviously I remember having a Nintendo, I can't remember what it was. I think it was one of the Game Boy things that came out maybe 10 years ago, and they had brain games on them, you know, and there was a handful of like online brain games. How is this different than, you know, quote unquote, all the brain games that we've seen over the years?
Yeah. So, you know, the concept of the brain game is a good one. It rests on a solid foundation of plasticity and challenge, basically what we've been talking about. But that's, you know, that's a low bar. That's like saying the idea of drugs are a good one, or the idea of food is a good idea. Like, the devil's in the details,
sure.
Right? All food acts differently. All drugs act differently, as we've come to understand that, you know, in a very deep way. And the same thing with experiences. Not all experiences are the same. So that's the challenge of the sort of brain game field, is that it rests on a strong premise. But once you create something that you think is going to have a meaningful and a sustainable effect, you have to actually study that and show that that's true. Mm-hmm. You can't just say, this is based on a good idea, here you go. And that's what really happened to the field. This is the danger of using science as a marketing tool, that you could say something's based on science. That's actually not true. First of all, everything we're doing now should be based on science, at least scientific ideas.
Right.
That's what they're saying.
Right.
Why would anyone do anything that's not?
Right.
So that's easy. The challenging thing is that it has been now validated by scientific methodology. That's what they're hoping that you might think when we say based on science.
Right.
But that's not always the case.
Well, yeah, the difference, I guess, is just a few game designers sitting around in a room coming up with an idea, deploying a game, and not really knowing the outcome, versus you're doing it at university level. You're like, you have these crazy trials. You bring people back in. You do the brain scans. You do all the hard work.
Yeah, it's hard work on both sides. So I've seen failures on both sides of this, on the tech development and on the scientific validation, both sides. And usually the failure is actually a disconnection between the two. So you could have people that are just, you know, they've been in the field, they're professionals, they're amazing, they know how to build, you know, incredible interactive experiences delivered through video games or other types of, you know, software. And they're great. But do they work? Who knows? Maybe they could work better if they had, you know, design principles that were more targeted to different brain systems, which is how we try to do it. And then you have scientists that know how to do really careful research studies, and then they use the most boring, you know, training game exercise you could ever imagine. I can't even conceive of someone sitting there for 10 minutes and not just trying to stay awake.
So is the compliance really low then?
Well, even if compliance is high enough, like someone knows they're going to get paid at the end of the study and they get through it, they might be measuring compliance by time engaged, but not depth engaged.
Mm.
And so this is a big concern of mine of why we see such negative findings, is that you either have these amazing game experiences in the consumer domain that we don't think are well targeted and they're not well tested. And then you have scientists that are studying the most boring possible interactive experiences I could ever imagine and saying, oh, it doesn't do anything. And so we've tried to really address that over the last decade here at UCSF, starting with that first video game in 2008, by developing at a high level, recognizing that there are professionals in the industry that know how to create interactive experiences that are just absorbing.
Right.
And then really...
Then you get the depth there.
Then you get
people
depth.
Really going in with their mind and really focusing
on becoming
better.
Because they care about it.
Right.
Because they're getting the rewards. They feel the draw to the story and the characters and the art, you know, and all different groups appeal to different type of content. And so you have to be very conscious of that. So And also, it's not just the depth, it's that the mechanics of the game are actually creating an experience that targets those brain networks that most need to be optimized. So this is the complexity. It takes us 2 years to build every game. So now at Neuroscape, our center here, we have 7 games that we've built over the last 5 years, and they all target different aspects of neural function, of how the networks are activated.
So what are you trying to target? What are you working on? What are those 7 things that you're trying to work on and improve?
So let me just finish one thought. So then on the other side, so you build at a high level, and then you have to do the really careful, double-blind, randomized control trial to figure out if it works.
Right.
So that's the two things. I just want to bring those together.
Yeah, it takes a lot of time to do
it. It takes us at least
and
expertise. It takes us 2 years to build every game, and I'll jump through them all right now. And it takes us at least 2 years to just do that first research study using MRIs and EEG and blood work, looking at telomere length and inflammatory markers and stress testing and sleep monitoring. I mean, we record everything before and after one of our 2-month game treatment experiences to see what changes. So it's just a long process.
Crazy.
Yeah, but that's the way to do it. At least that's what I think.
Well, tell people what you're working on. What are you trying to target?
Yeah, so with that framework in mind, over the last, 5 years now, we've been moving beyond what we did with NeuroRacer. So NeuroRacer was the first game that we built based on this idea of a closed loop experience. And it was published in Nature in 2013, showing that we improve how older adults not just play NeuroRacer, but their attention and their working memory, two things that we've already talked about, tested outside of the game. Mm-hmm. And also, importantly, showing that only one version of the game that actually challenges interference, improves those abilities, and not another version that doesn't challenge interference. Mm. So we found the active ingredient in that experience. And we should come back and talk about Achille, which took that game and now is taking it, to an insane area of ADHD treatment. Mm. But back at Neuroscape, we had this, really powerful example of how we can build a game and have these meaningful improvements in cognition in older adults, and was like, let's do that again.
Before you go into that, you got to tell people the results, because they're just fascinating. Of that study and what it was able to do in older adults.
Yeah, so basically what we showed is that the older adults played for 12 hours over the course of a month, 1 hour a day, 3 days a week at home. And we tested their ability before and after to remember faces, mm-hmm. which is totally different than the game environment, and also to sustain their attention in a very boring vigilance task, very different than the game environment. And on both of those, we were able to show significant, meaningful improvement, and not in the control group that played a different version of the game. And so what we're able to show here is that by challenging the neural network of the prefrontal cortex, which with the rest of the brain, we actually recorded brain activity during gameplay to show what changes in the brain as you go through this process.
That's so cool.
And what we show is that the change in the prefrontal cortical network correlates with their ability to maintain their improvement 6 months later on the game. And also,
6 months without playing the game?
Without playing the game.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's all these really fascinating little pieces of that story. And also their improvement on very different tasks, like this attention task, sustained attention. And so that gave us this, nugget there that there's a signal that we're on the right path. We could do this better now, because obviously it was just our first pass.
Can you tell us how much they improved? Because you compared it to younger adults as well, right?
Yeah, across several of the metrics, they actually reached 20-year-old levels.
And how old was the population?
These are 60 to 80-year-olds. Never played video games before, haven't used tech. So
do they stay at 20-year-old levels for how long?
So we don't know that, because we haven't done full, very longitudinal studies. We're doing that now on our new research. But we did show that the actual ability to multitask on the game itself now seems to be preserved 6 years later. Because we've brought back those participants. This is unpublished. This is a very new look in what happened to the population from that Nature paper.
This is so crazy. Yeah. This is why this is the future of medicine.
I couldn't be more excited by what we're seeing all the time, especially in our new treatment. So, I mean, we call them treatments because we really try to take them very, very seriously in how we formulate them and then how we test them. So some of the new ones, for example, I'll just run through them and we could talk about whichever ones you want, because they all have sort of interesting stories. So we have a game that we call Body Brain Trainer, which integrates physical fitness challenges and cognitive fitness challenges using motion capture. and also physiological recordings of your heart rate, all in closed loop. And we have a game called MetaTrain, which uses principles of concentrative meditation and then integrates that with closed loop. So you get feedback and adaptivity on how well you're focusing internally. Mm-hmm. We have a game called Rhythmicity, where we use the principles that we think guide and are responsible for the benefits of music and music training through rhythm to help improve anticipation and timing in the brain. We have a game called Labyrinth, which is played in virtual reality on an omnidirectional treadmill, where you have to gradually, in a closed loop, figure your way out of and do different tasks in a 3D environment.
I want to try that. I haven't tried most of these games.
Try,
it kills
you try
me.
Try them all. They're all downstairs, right in this building. And we think that that's going to improve memory abilities, because spatial navigation is tied to a lot of the sort of ancient system memory systems of the hippocampus. And so there's a couple. As I said, they each take a couple of years to build and to beta test and make sure we're targeting what we want to. And now most of those, except Labyrinth, which we're just finishing now, are in longitudinal trials to figure out if they work or if they don't.
So the thing that kills me about research, you know, I read like Science Daily and some of these sites that show all the latest published studies. And the thing that kills me is I read stuff like what you're talking about right now, and the public is not going to see this for like another 5 or 10 years. Like, is there, you must be, I mean, I know you've been on a bunch of different podcasts and things like that. You must just be inundated with people saying, I want this tech right now. I want a 20-year-old brain.
It's the single most frustrating part of my life is the fact that I would say I'm cautiously optimistic about what we're doing here. The scientist in me wants to hold it for as long as possible, for as much research to be produced, so that when we finally put it into the public domain, we could say with confidence that this does what we say it's going to do on who it's going to help. And it takes a long time to do that. And so we have been patient. You know, all the games that I just described to you, MetaTrain, Body Brain Trainer, Engage, I didn't tell you about Engage, but Labyrinth, they're all in research at UCSF. The one that's closest to getting into the public is what NeuroRacer became, which is a game we called Evo, Project Evolution, which was now developed at a much higher level and researched at a bigger scale by a company I founded called Achille. Mm-hmm. And so, this is the closest, you know, so now my reply is next year. It used to be, I don't know, in the future, but I would say what I really hope, obviously there's still a couple of steps in front of us, is that by next year, the first thing that we created, that I designed and filed a patent on in 2008, and just approved recently as a patent, is going to enter the world as a product.
Now, this has to be cleared, but why does this have to be cleared by the FDA?
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. So each of those games has intellectual property around it, which makes them more attractive to companies to then move them into products. So at Neuroscape, at UCSF, we build prototypes. We don't build products. That's just not what we do. It's not what we're designed to do. And also the studies we do are like deep dives to figure out if there's something there that's interesting, not like these large scale trials on hundreds of people to move it into practice. So Neuroscape does that. Prototype development, deep dive research. Achille, the company that I co-founded to move this into the world, does product development. Mm-hmm. So they licensed the technology from UCSF, who owns that first patent I filed on NeuroRacer, now built a way better game in every manner. And Achille made the very unique decision to move it into the world. They would do so not by taking it through a consumer route, not putting it out there as like the latest, but the best brain game you've ever seen.
Which they could have.
But rather to take it through a clinical route. So Achille is a healthcare company, and these games are now being validated at the highest level of regulatory approval as medical devices. And so this is a very interesting and actually polarizing, as I've discovered, decision. Mm-hmm. The reason we did this is because if you want to have a claim, what we call an indication in the medical world, if you want to say, mom of child with ADHD or doctor of patient with ADHD, we have a treatment for you. You don't have to go to Adderall. You could try this. In order to say that, you need to have FDA approval.
Right.
It is illegal not to. You'll be shut down. That is that is just how the system has evolved over the last century. So if you want to say, hey, here's an attention game, that's one thing. But what we wanted to do is really change how we think about medicine, how everyone thinks about it.
So basically, you wanted to get inside the doctor's office.
Yeah.
Which is where you can't be, right? Like, so you want to be in the room when the decision is being made to put someone on a drug and have an alternative option.
Yep. We want this to go on a prescription pad. We want it to be thought of as in every way medicine as we think about drugs right now. We want it to be reimbursed. We want the whole thing. And that has never happened, and it won't happen unless at least now we play the rules of the game.
So
and the rules of the game
are
FDA approval.
Where are you in that process?
So we completed what's known as a phase 3 clinical trial last year. So as you move through the stages, so if this was a drug, let's say, you go through these stages, preclinical, which is actually animal testing. We didn't have to do that because we're not very dangerous. But if this was a drug, and then you go through phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, where you get more and more people involved and you check for side effects along the way. And then when you have your phase 3 data, you submit that to the FDA for approval of a drug or a device. So we finished a phase 3 trial. It's the first ever of its type. So it's a prospective, double-blind, randomized controlled trial across 20 sites around the U.S. on 350 kids that have been diagnosed with ADHD.
Wow.
So it took almost 2 years with a placebo control arm as well, another game that we didn't think would have the same impact. And we showed and reported in December the results of that study. So I'm actually not a researcher on that study. I did the foundational work in the development of NeuroRacer.
Because you'd be conflicted at that point.
Yeah, because so I'm a founder in the company. I own the patent on the technology. It's better for my colleagues to now take this through the rest of the way. And so the PI is an amazing physician scientist, Scott Collins at Duke. And what the report was of that trial was that we were able to improve the attention abilities of kids with ADHD using a diagnostic, an FDA-approved diagnostic of attention deficits in ADHD, only in the group that played this game and not in a control group.
Wow.
And the amount and all that we'll be announcing in a paper. And so what's happening right now is that we're submitting that to the FDA as a proposal for what's known as a de novo pathway, a new category of medicine, essentially, to treat pediatric ADHD. So when we get approval, I'm optimistic, but we still have that step left and it could take a while, that we'll have the first non-drug treatment for ADHD and the first prescribable video game.
Wow. That's amazing.
And what's most exciting though, is that it opens up a new category of medicine. So right now, the only treatment we have for this and many other conditions are pharmaceutical medicines that deliver molecular treatments. What we're talking about here is a digital medicine that delivers an experiential treatment. The medicine is not the video game. The video game is the pill, right? This is the delivery system of the algorithms which create the experience, which is actually the medicine. Hmm. And so that doesn't exist right now when it comes to the brain and the mind. So we have other studies in depression and post-traumatic stress disorder and autism and depression and Alzheimer's disease, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, all underway now. All will advance through this pipeline and hopefully we'll have medicines for all these treatments.
That's awesome. Well, so for people that don't have access to this obviously right now, what do you recommend to keep a brain healthy? What can they do today? I mean, is exercise a big part of your kind of daily regimen? Like what would you, if someone was coming in to see you and said, I just really want to work on my attention or...
Yeah, it's a question I get asked a lot. And I ask myself that question. I always like try to make it clear, like, I'm not some Luddite that sits on some mountain, doesn't use technology and engages in their environment perfectly. Like I struggle with exactly the same things most people do.
I'm looking at your computer behind you. you got a lot of windows open.
Yeah, it's a lot of real estate there.
Yeah, a couple screens.
Yeah, so we could talk about that because that was always a topic when I did interviews about the Distracted Mind book that I wrote. But I think that one point I want to make, and then I'm going to answer that, is that these technologies that we're creating, I want to be really clear that I don't view them as replacements of real life activities of things that are good for your brain. These are in real like medicine. They're optimization tools that should be used in small doses at in a prescribed fashion just to help really improve function, especially if there's a deficiency there. Mm-hmm. So that's the reality. And so it will never replace all the other things that we know are good for your brain, at least in in my mind, it shouldn't. So I always view like five things, the five pillars of brain health that I constantly try to return to. So number one, just in terms of evidence, is physical exercise, mm-hmm. undoubtedly. Maintaining brain health throughout our lives, especially, you know, as we get a lot older, but also during development.
Do high intensity interval training?
Yeah, I do high intensity interval training, both physical, both aerobic training, but also weight training has mm-hmm. been found to have benefits, especially together. So you know, but you know, if just going out for walks is all that you're physically capable of, benefits have been shown for that as well. So, you know, moving the body, right, you know, at the highest level of evidence that we have. Cognitive challenge in general, whether, you know, that's social or just pushing yourself out of that comfort zone. Our brain does not respond well to comfort. It responds to challenge. Mm-hmm. And so that's critical. Related to that is stress. Stress management. Again, that does not mean no stress. No stress is also not good for us.
Right.
We respond to challenge and stress. It's the helpless kind of stress that you don't want to have. You want to have stress that you actually can manage.
How do you manage your stress?
Well, I mean, so let me finish the five and then through that.
I'm keep going on these little side tangents.
No, it's
you can
awesome.
See where my brain goes.
So, okay, because I'll say, well, remember where we're up to. Okay, so physical fitness, physical yes. exercise, cognitive challenge, stress, nutrition, and obviously the devil's in the details yeah. of all of these. Not that we know all the answers. And then the last one is sleep. Incredibly important.
Oh, man, that's the biggest for me. I can really notice the difference.
Yeah, my buddy Matt Walker has a great book out now, Why We Sleep, How We Sleep.
Do you remember what it's called?
Yeah, Why We Sleep.
Why We Sleep.
Yeah. And it's really a great, great read and really describes, you know, a lot of the science behind it and also how critically important it is for restoration, for memory, for mood. And, you know, so all those things together, I think, are a recipe for keeping our brain healthy. But obviously, what is the physical exercise program? What is the nutrition recommendations that we want to give and receive? How do you manage stress? And this is what, you know, we don't know all the answers to these. This is what yeah. we struggle with in a lot of ways. And, you know, there's a lot of strong views and not a ton of data on what, you know, in really tight randomized controlled trials of what is the perfect recipe of these five ingredients. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I experiment with my own, you know, recipe of those and try to find one that works for me. And then I'm constantly assessing my own ability, sometimes quantitatively, sometimes just by observation and refining it.
But you're more on the in the camp of just getting a little bit into the details here of a less refined carbohydrate.
Yes.
More anti-inflammatory kind of diet.
For sure. For sure. That's definitely how I try to eat. And you know, I'm usually fairly successful, not all the time, but
I've been with you a couple of times when we have not been successful.
Yes, we have erred. we sometimes, yes, go off the rails a bit.
That's
but
right.
As long as you get back on them. And, you know, I work out, you know, minimum 5 days a week, you know, physical fitness. Sleep has been something I've abused most of my life, but I do respect the data and what Matt tells me all the time. And so I've really directed that a lot better and really tried to give it the proper attention that it deserves.
Do you take any supplements at all?
Nope.
None?
Nope.
Wow.
Yep, I don't. So, you know, most of my readings on nutrition really, in my mind, support that if you are fortunate enough to have access to a diet that's, you know, well-balanced, nutritious, that, you know, that is sufficient. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I don't take supplements like that. You know, trying to challenge, you know, cognitively myself is just, you know.
That's probably a lot of your day-to-day job.
That's my everyday.
Yeah.
That's my everyday.
One question about some of the crazier research that I've heard that you partake in around the TDC,
transcranial direct current stimulation.
Yeah,
actually,
yeah.
We do a lot more transcranial alternating current stimulation, TACS.
Yeah, so tell us about that real quick.
Yeah, so part of our research program here at Neuroscape is to start with the core that we've been talking about, experiential treatments delivered through video games and the benefits that they could have on cognition, and then figure out how we can take that framework and enhance it.
Amplify it.
So we have something that we believe works. How do we just boost it up?
Wait, for one second, let me just step back and explain to people what is happening on the biohacking side of things, which I'm sure you find really scary. But people are going out and buying these devices that they'll hook up to their heads, and they look on online forums and they find a little space on their head, a certain part of the brain. They hook up a little, what do we call it? Like a little diode or
electrode.
And then they apply a current, like from a battery, like into their brain. They're doing this on their own without doctor's supervision. And I'm not saying you should do this. You should not do this. But they get these crazy benefits from learning and anti-depression and a whole slew of different things. That's what's happening in the unregulated side of things. I'm curious to see what you're doing on the university side of things.
Yeah, so there's a whole field in transcranial electrical and magnetic stimulation. We do both of them. Electrically, we do both direct current and alternating current. And the literature shows that this can help essentially increase plasticity by activating those brain areas and, you know, allowing them to modify themselves more readily. That's at least the suggestions that we're seeing and the conclusions of a lot of research. But what I think is that they're not very targeted, right? They're very diffuse, especially the electrical. The magnetic is more focused than the electrical. Mm. And so they have a lot of similar problems to pharmaceuticals in that way. Mm. And so
what are the side effects?
Well, the side effects are fairly low from a lot of the research, but we don't really know fully when it comes to chronic use, especially if you're at doses that have not been tested. So this is the concern of doing things unregulated, in that we really just don't know. As we don't know, you know, a lot of what people put in their mouths either are going to do. And so my interest in transcranial stimulation is to apply these electrical currents during gameplay. So use the experience for what it does best, which is to activate the network selectively, and then see how things like electrical stimulation or even pharmaceuticals layered on top of that might now benefit from the selectivity of the experience to now lead to greater effects. Hmm. So for example, in the pharmaceutical world, maybe the future will have children, at least at the beginning, using a tenth of a dose of Adderall with one of our games to get additional benefit, and then they could come off that. So just using it as an activator. Maybe the same thing with brain stimulation. So we have two papers over the last couple of years that's showing that an hour of gameplay in 20-year-olds on NeuroRacer, while we stimulate the prefrontal cortex with a low frequency electrical vibration of rhythm, essentially what we call in the theta range, low frequency, helps improve performance on the game over the course of an hour. Hmm. So if we stimulate, you know, differently, we don't get the same degree of performance improvement. It's actually fairly flat, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
The big question is now, does that lead to greater transfer effects?
Right.
That's what we really want.
Does that stick? Does that hold over?
Yeah. And does it lead to, so what we're doing now is the same study that we did in the Nature paper, where we had older adults play NeuroRacer for 12 hours over the course of the month and look at the benefits. Now we're trying to figure out if we could have those same benefits in 3 hours with brain stimulation. And we're actually doing that study now.
Wow. Are you going to be doing that with the meditation app as well? That would be fascinating.
I mean, the future is an integration of every one of these things. How I don't want to step in the same, you know, sort of footsteps that we've taken with the pharmaceutical industry of putting a silo around every single drug. I'm really interested in how the games interact with each other. I'm interested in how we can apply other tools on top of it, like stimulation and drugs. We're also now gathering and capturing neural signals in real time using brain recording and feeding that data into the game engine. Now the game is not just responsive to how fast or accurate you are, it's actually challenging you and giving you rewards based upon what is going on in your brain at the moment.
Can you do that?
Yeah.
You could do that at the university level because you have the caps and everything.
Yeah, we could do that here.
Could you do that at the home level?
We're getting very close to be able to do that at the home level with caps. So that's our goal, is always to get these things to the home. So we're looking at in the next 10 years is an integration of all of these tools with virtual reality, augmented reality, better physiological recordings. And then what you can see here is we have this very complex closed loop. All this information about you flowing into a software in the moment to allow that software to challenge you and reward you appropriately in real time. This is the ultimate opportunity in my mind for artificial intelligence, for machine learning here. This is what my dream is, that AI is for HI. How do we use artificial intelligence to advance human intelligence? That should be the goal, at least how I think about it. And so we have an opportunity to create like an optimizer as an AI, like maybe a robot in the future, something that really understands you in a deep, comprehensive way in the moment, and then is creating an environment to nurture you and to enhance what makes you most human, but not to just offload it.
So would you, one of the things that you always hear about when you talk about AI or machine learning is that you need to have a very deep data set. You know, do you have to go out there and be in, you know, millions of homes with something like this and then be collecting this data and then use something like machine learning to jump on top of it and kind of make sense of how to better do dynamic-based training?
Yeah, that's definitely our future. We'll start it not with brain recordings, but just distributing like some of the games that we've created to a million people. That's our goal. We've talked about that.
Yeah.
So like our meditation training game, a perfect one. No side effects, uses an ancient practice in a modern delivery system, could be cloud-based. We've already showed improvement of even 20-year-olds playing MetaTrain in our research here. We're actually writing that paper up right now. If we could distribute that around the world, which is easy, right? We've already done that with many other mobile apps. The technology, the devices exist everywhere. We could start collecting data at the first step of how people engage, right? How they change over time, how their performance modulates. Now you put on a physiological device, you know, now we're 5 years in the future, let's say. Now we're looking at how the heart rate variability changes, how their skin conductivity changes. Maybe they have glasses on, we're looking at their pupil responses.
Oh, yeah.
Now we're a little further in the future. Now we have brain recordings. And so we build up, you're right, a very rich data set that allows us to use machine learning approaches to know how we can help each person maintain optimal function.
Yeah, it's cool because like I'm as I'm sure you are, you even more so, you're seeing all these devices just come online, like the Oura Ring doing real-time HRV, and you see that it's just a matter of time, right?
Yeah.
It's just like the next 5-10 years are going to be so amazing.
Yeah. You know, one thing I think that connects us, given what you've worked on and what I work on, is just what I believe is this amazing opportunity to use technologies that are consumer-facing, non-invasive, accessible around the world, affordable, to improve our functioning as humans, our brains and the rest of us. And that is, I think, the next great frontier for tech in general. And not just, you know, I'm not as attracted to implanting electrodes and fully cyborgizing us.
I mean, that's kind of cool stuff, though.
It's kind of cool. And I read a lot of science fiction, and I'm glad someone's working on it because I find it fascinating. And I think for some people, you know, that have debilitating neurological conditions, it could be the only thing that works. But personally, what makes me more excited is the non-invasive approach and how much we can do, because we will have the opportunity to help so many more people.
Cool. Well, thanks for agreeing to do this interview. Two last lightning questions. If you had to pick one sci-fi book and recommend it to people to read, what would it be? You get one, Desert Island.
I think maybe Tim asked me something like this. I always go back to Isaac Asimov and the Foundation.
Yeah.
It really sets all of this up, this whole story. I still find things that were described in that, you know, book, I think from the 50s, that really resonate right now in terms of use of AI and, holograms. And so I would say the Foundation series by Isaac Asimov should be the staple that everyone that's interested in sci-fi, I read pretty much every day, a little bit of sci-fi, should start there.
Awesome. And then last question, where can people find your book and also more about you, your research?
Neuroscape.ucsf.edu is our website for our UCSF Research Center. And there's tons of information on there. The book is called The Distracted Mind. It's pretty easy to find with the title. You know, we constantly update our site with new research and new talks that I give. So that's probably a good place to start.
Do you tweet at all, or do you?
I tweet a bit. I do Facebook a bit
what's
more.
What's your Twitter
Adam hand? Gaz. Adam Gaz. Okay. Yep. Adam Gaz. Instagram.
G-A-Z-Z.
Yeah. ADAMGAZZ. Yeah, for sure.
Awesome. Well, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Kevin. It's been great.
That is it for this episode of The Kevin Rose Show. I hope you enjoyed it. Two things you can do to help out. First thing is to head on over to kevinrose.com and you can check out the show notes there. So if you missed anything and you want any links, I have them all there. But you can also sign up and subscribe to my newsletter. There's a little newsletter tab there. You can click on it and join 100,000 other people that receive my once a month newsletter of all the crazy random stuff that I'm finding out there. The other thing, and possibly even more important, would be to give us a 5-star review on iTunes. So head on over to iTunes or wherever you're receiving this podcast, could be Google Play, and go ahead and rank us 5 stars. I would really appreciate it. It gets us recommended to more people, and that means we have more listeners, and that means in turn we have better guests. Thank you so much, and be well.